Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to The Andrew Lawton Show, Canada's most irreverent talk show here on True North, Thursday, April 25th. And we are going to have a grand old time here as we close out the week, at least insofar as The Andrew Lawton Show is concerned. But we got Off the Record coming up on, tomorrow. I don't know why I was going to give a day of the week there. And also, I should make a point of letting you know, if you're in the Ottawa area, I'm going to be speaking this weekend on Sunday on a panel about my favorite topics, free speech, ethics, and democracy. It's going to be at the Lansdowne Park Horticulture Building. It's part of the Ottawa Food and Book Expo, and I like both food and books. Ottawa, I'm a little bit iffy on, but I like food and books, and I'm indifferent to expos, but I think it'll be a grand old time. Julie Panessi, who has been on the show a couple of times, will be on the panel as well, as will Randy Hillier, who dislikes me because he's always like firing like these pot shots at me on Twitter, but I've only ever had favorable interactions with him in person. So it should be fun, but that's going to be coming up on Sunday. So if you are in Ottawa and you want to get some tickets, you can head over to Eventbrite. And I think if you search my name, I believe this is the only thing that comes up. So if there's another Andrew Lawton that's, some folk singer touring Dubuque, Iowa on Sunday, that's not me. I'm the one at the Ottawa Food and Book Expo. But that should be great fun there. Wanted to kick things off by revisiting this capital gains increase in the budget. Now, to be fair, when the Liberal government announced the increase to the capital gains tax in the budget that was released last week, I didn't think that would be the thing to get legs, but it has gotten legs. It has been a thing that a lot of people have been talking about. One of the more notable criticisms of this was from Canadian doctors who were saying, well, hold on. I mean, doctors, if they have professional corporations, which most of them or almost all of them in private practice do, they've been using capital gains basically as their retirement plan. So now when government is putting a pretty significant increase to the capital gains tax, that is going to disadvantage Canadian doctors, so much so that many of them have said they will probably shut down their practices, retire early, or leave the country altogether. Now, this is a country in which it's very difficult for a lot of people to get a family doctor or to get access to a family doctor if you have one. So when you've got doctors that are, by and large, not a particularly political group getting up and saying, whoa, 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 this is a big problem here. That's what the Canadian Medical Association did. Governments should pay attention. But it was amazing how one of the ministers that was dispatched to the media to defend and sell the budget really had no answer whatsoever for this. This is the small business minister in Canada, going up against David Poutine for the CBC, Cochrane. Take a look.
There has been some pushback that this could affect family doctors and other professionals who incorporate their practice for the tax advantages that a corporation would have. So while individually, if they were, say, working, in a hospital, they would not necessarily be affected by the new capital gains inclusion. But if their corporate structure is such that they're relying on corporate investments to pay for their future and their retirement, they're going to be hit. And that in a country that's already struggling to have enough family doctors, this creates a disincentive for some of them to work in Canada.
We recognize that, but one of the things that we will continue to do is encourage foreign credential recognition to help. We know that coming out of the pandemic, our healthcare has really been hampered, and there's a really challenge with labor. But the investments we made with foreign credentialing, we've already made a significant investment in previous budgets, and in this year we've topped that up, and we will continue to invest to ensure we're encouraging bringing talent from other countries to get their credentials recognized, and that will also encourage them to get more jobs here and fill the desperate labor market needs that are required in our healthcare industry.
No, and I understand the impetus to try to accelerate health professionals in particular to be able to work in Canada through the standard. But if doctors who are here now, who are set up through the existing corporate structure that relies heavily on capital gains income for their retirement and for their future because they wouldn't have a pension in this sort of a situation, if they balk at the situation that has been created by this change, I mean, how do you deal with that? The goal is to not increase the gap in medical coverage, right? So how do you respond to the concerns being raised by people in that sector that this is potentially punitive to them?
If I take a step back to what I mentioned earlier, and you heard the Prime Minister said it, what we're really trying to do is really create a Canada that is fair for every generation.
So her answer to, hey, all of these doctors are concerned they're going to leave the country. What are you going to do? Don't worry about it. We'll just make sure we bring in some foreign doctors and that'll be that, and we'll get their credentials recognized. Now, to be fair, I don't think she's as dumb as she sounds. I think what's happened is ministers get loaded up with so many talking points. She's been told, okay, doctors, anytime you're asked about a doctor shortage, talk about foreign credential recognition. And she just like only heard the word doctors and was like going through the mental Rolodex. Hang on, I've got a talking point about doctors. I've got not documents, foreign credential. And then she just committed to it because her answer actually had nothing to do with the federal budget. It had nothing to do with the question that was asked. It, to be honest, had nothing to do with what we would argue is perhaps common sense or reason. But you know what? She was doing her best there. The question had doctor in it, so she found an answer that had doctor in it, and that was it. And then when he follows up and says, well, hang on, okay, yeah, that's all well and good, but what about doctors who are literally leaving the country right now? Then she says, well, it's about fair. Then at that point, you just go to the generic talking point, the I've run out of things to say talking point, and you default to, well, this budget is about fairness. This budget is about fairness. It's like the old joke I told after watching an Aaron O'Toole press conference. If my wife asks me if I empty the dishwasher, I say, well, you know, I'm a big fan of clean dishes, and that's basically it. And we don't need to get down into anything resembling facts or sense or a connection of the answer to the question. But all of that is to say that the federal government right now is getting hit from all sides on this. They're getting hit from a lot of their own wealthy elites that are like, hang on, why are you going after my capital gains tax? And a lot of people that are middle-class Canadians, many doctors in this country are not wealthy. They have, in lieu of fee increases, received an arrangement by which they can make investments through their professional corporations. And now they're going to see a steep increase in the taxes that they pay on those. So the capital gains increase isn't just this crusade against the rich and wealthy. It's not just about the people with yachts and private jets, as Justin Trudeau would have you believe. It's about a group that is, generally speaking, broader than that. And the government still keeps holding to this idea that it's about fairness. Here's Chrystia Freeland.
Ask about changes to the capital gain tax, and you know, we've heard from local positions that they're concerned about how this will impact recruitment and retention when we have doctor shortages in Newfoundland and Labrador and across the country. What do you say to them right now?
Well, look, I would start by talking about what the objective of our budget is, what the mission of our budget is. And our budget is about fairness for all Canadians, about giving all Canadians, especially younger Canadians, millennials and Gen Z, a real opportunity to have a middle-class life. And we know that that requires investments. It requires investments in housing. It requires investments in affordability. It requires investments in economic growth. And so to make those investments, we need to find a way to finance them. And what we're saying in the budget is we're asking those in our country who are doing the best to contribute a little bit more. And that really is fair.
Fairness is the name of the game. Today's show is brought to you by the letter F. Fairness, 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 fairness. So anytime they're facing any questions about it as well, it's you know, we're all about the fairness. This is not fair what we have now. And it's the same mentality that we had in that clip I shared yesterday of Justin Trudeau talking about how the economy is not working for young Canadians. The same people who bristled at anyone who has said that Canada is broken are now saying that Canada is not a fair country to live in. Canada is not fair. It's not fair to younger people. Now, look, I would agree that the deck is stacked against them, but I would also agree that the appropriate time to talk about this would have been years ago when other people were, and you were just saying, oh, no, it's all sunny ways. Everything's fine. Everything is all hunky-dory. And the Liberals have been so focused on pursuing an agenda of censorship, curtailing civil liberties, and not focused on the structural barriers that exist between Canadians who want to live a pleasant, comfortable, middle-class existence and that existence itself. And I wanted to, just before we get into this a bit further with Aaron Woodrick, who will be joining us in a couple of moments, and I want to talk about this big Honda announcement as well. I wanted to bring up this clip from Australia, which I found quite amusing. So you may know that Canada is in the process right now of trying to push forward a rather significant curtailing of your right to speak and debate and discuss online. It's Bill C-63. I've talked about it extensively and will continue to. But one of the things that I always bring up is that you have to trust that a government that is going to give itself the power to regulate speech is going to be motivated by the right things to use that power. And I just simply do not trust government to do, well, most things, but certainly to do that. So here is Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese as Exhibit A on why you should not trust governments with this power.
Media platforms have a responsibility to make sure that misinformation isn't got out there. I noticed today, for example, on the way up here, they've removed various sites that were up containing fake images of myself superimposed on other people. That's the sort of thing that is going on social media. Social media has a responsibility to do the right thing here.
So the Prime Minister of Australia, by the way, a far cry from former PM Tony Abbott that we had on the show a couple of weeks ago. I like Tony Abbott a lot more than Albanese here, but he's basically using as his example, his pride, his joy that tech companies have taken down things he doesn't like about himself. So the Australian government has used online harms, online safety, misinformation as a cudgel to go after people that post satirical images that the ruling class finds offensive to its sensibilities. Now, whether he was personally sitting in his office and said, I want that one gone, I want that one gone, I want that one gone, I don't know, probably not, but he is certainly cheering for that use of the law. So this is why I do not trust at all for a second the idea that a prime minister like Justin Trudeau or anyone else, liberal, conservative, even some hypothetical situation in which Jagmeet Singh manages to claim an iota of relevance and becomes prime minister himself, none of these people should have that power, because they're only going to use it to uphold the regime. They're going to use it to take away criticisms. Just one story very briefly. I had a couple of years back the opportunity to go to London, England for the Global Conference for Media Freedom, which Canada was co-hosting with the UK. And in the course of this, Chrystia Freeland got up on stage and was lauding the, I forget his name, it was Singh Deol, I believe, or Singh Deol, Gobinder Singh Deol. He was the Malaysian Minister of Communications or something of that sort. And she was holding him up as being this, you know, hero to press freedom. And I Googled for, you know, all of like 3 seconds or whatever, and found that he had tried to weaponize Malaysia's online speech laws against a blogger who lived in a different country because that blogger was saying mean things about him. And Malaysia is a country where the government can get away with doing that, but we can't import that sensibility into Western nations. So good on the Australian Prime Minister for saying the quiet part out loud, which is that he loves the government's ability to censor online because he doesn't like when people post satirical images of him online. That is, thank you, Prime Minister, for making our point for us. I couldn't come up with a better criticism of this bill than you saying what you've been using that law for yourself. Well, let's shift gears here, no pun intended, to yet another big ticket automotive funding announcement from the federal government in Canada and also the provincial government in Ontario. Justin Trudeau stood and made this proclamation about Honda today.
Today, Honda is making Canadian automotive history. With this announcement, we will be investing to create Canada's first comprehensive electric vehicle supply chain from start to finish. Aujourd'hui, on annonce que Honda va investir pour créer la première chaîne d'approvisionnement complète de véhicules électriques au Canada. A whole ecosystem will be built with 4 new manufacturing plants in Ontario, including an EV assembly plant, a standalone battery manufacturing plant, and 2 plants for battery components. These investments will create well over 1,000 well-paying manufacturing jobs, as well as many, many construction jobs, and of course, jobs all across Ontario and the country for auto parts suppliers. But this announcement isn't just about creating jobs. It's about securing good jobs and careers for the coming decades and even the coming generations. Honda has set a goal to make EVs represent 100% of vehicle sales by 2040. In Canada, our target is that 100% of all light-duty cars and passenger truck sales be zero emission by 2035. And that underlines what we've always said. Climate policy is economic policy. And with its impact on families and communities around here, it's also social policy.
Wow, it sounds phenomenal. It's social policy, it's environmental policy, it's economic policy, it's great. You notice in that announcement, he mentioned that Honda is investing $15 billion. He's there announcing Honda's investment. Honda's putting the money forward. Well, look, I think if Honda wants to spend $15 billion and build 4 electric vehicle plants in Ontario, that's great. But it isn't just Honda that is putting money towards this. This part has been buried a little bit, even in the government press release. It's way, way, way down below what Honda's putting up. It's what you and I are putting up. Aaron Woodrick is with me. He is the head of the domestic policy program over at the McDonald Laurier Institute. Aaron, what are we missing here? It's not just Honda's money, is it?
No, it's not. And you wondered if it was Honda's money, what on earth would all these politicians be doing there stepping up to a podium? It's great if you have a company that wants to invest that kind of money in Canada. That's a great sign. But of course, the devil's in the details. And it turns out, Andrew, you and I and other taxpayers in Canada and Ontario, we're on the hook for $5 billion. Out of that $15 billion. So a whole third of that is going to be coming out of our pockets to go to Honda, who are doing okay. I checked this morning when I saw the announcement. You know, they made $8 billion US in global profit last year. So this is not a company that is hard done by. This is clearly a company that's got the resources to invest their own money, which is great, and they should do that, and we should welcome that. But that does not explain why Canadian taxpayers are being forced to stick $5 billion of their own money. You know, that we pay taxes for public services, Andrew. Instead, they're turning around and giving it to a very profitable multinational corporation.
I don't consider myself to be a mathematician. I, you know, always double check with a calculator to make sure I'm not getting anything right. But I was told that this would create 1,000 jobs. Now, you may think, okay, 1,000 jobs, that's phenomenal. And I remember billions are the ones with 9 zeros. So I can work back from there. That works out to be, again, correct my math here, $5 million per job.
That's exactly right. And Andrew, it is as crazy as it sounds. People might say, well, that doesn't sound quite right. Well, it is right. They are actually subsidizing the equivalent of $5 million per job. So you heard the Prime Minister there. He said they'd be well-paying jobs. Boy, I hope they're really well-paying jobs if we're paying $5 million a pop just to create them.
Yeah. And again, I mean, not that I'm recommending this as policy, but it would literally be cheaper just to walk around Alvaston and give everyone $1 million and would probably have more of an economic benefit because then at least their people are spending it. Like this is absurd. And there's no ROI on this. Like you'll never make that money back.
No, and look, you know, the government always has, I know all the lines right now. If you're familiar with these types of announcements, you can pretty much sing the song. They're going to talk about spinoffs. They're going to talk about, you know, other impacts in the community. But the reality is we are paying these companies to create these jobs. You know, Andrew, when I hear politicians talk about good paying jobs and the importance of them, that's always on the presumption that they're being generated by the private sector. If you're going in and essentially paying the salary of these people for the company, it's not really a private sector job. It's essentially a government job masquerading as a private sector job. That has a very different impact, a very different impact on the bottom line of the government, right? The whole reason we want these jobs is because they generate tax revenue that we can spend on public services. Instead, these kinds of announcements, they are taking resources out, things we're not spending on things like roads and hospitals and schools and the kinds of things you expect your tax money is supposed to go towards.
Well, and the other part of it too is that the companies themselves tend to have very little in the way of oversight to maximize how many jobs they're creating. I mean, one big example this week has been the letter from the union representing a lot of workers at the Stellantis plant in Windsor that they're building. And they're saying, well, hold on, we were told this was going to be to create Canadian jobs, yet we're seeing a large number of foreign workers that are being brought in. So Korean workers are benefiting from this money that the federal and provincial governments have given to Stellantis and LG. And of course, the government says, oh, well, it's, you know, specialized skills and whatnot. And then you have Oakville and Ford, again, a heavily subsidized EV battery plant delayed, I think, until 2027. So now you have a company that is, for business reasons, as it's permitted to do, dragging its heels on this. So we're not even getting the benefit of these jobs that we were all promised. And this is happening time and time again in these cases where it's not even like that core deliverable even pans out.
Well, it never does. And it's because it comes down to the fact the government is trying to, they're trying to do central planning here within it, with what, who's supposed to be a private actor. I mean, just the very fact that you're setting a number saying you have to hire 1,000 people. Well, companies normally hire based on what they need, right? They hire or let people go based on their economic need, what makes sense for them, what they can afford. The government sets this number. I mean, it doesn't make sense to tell a company you have to hire exactly 1,000 people or you don't. I mean, it is just completely undermines the very ethos of like a private sector company. The other thing, Andrew, that I noticed that was interesting is they mentioned in the press release that it's not just about the 1,000 new jobs, which, by the way, are often just jobs taken from other sectors. They're not net new jobs. They talk about retaining existing jobs. So that starts to sound to me a lot like something like a ransom fee, right? You've got 4,000 people already employed at this plant. You know, be a real shame if something happened to those jobs if we don't get this handout. So I find that a very troubling development.
One of the arguments that you always get from people on this, and I'm curious how you refute it, is this idea that, well, this is just the these are the rules of the game, and is that if we don't, you know, Iowa's going to, or New York State is going to, and we just don't get any of it. And you saw this particularly exploited by Amazon when they were launching their, you know, Amazon headquarters, and they basically just put out this open call, hey, who's going to pay us the most to set up shop there? But what is the answer to that? Because no one likes this idea that, you know, we just say, all right, we're not going to play this game. All right, well, everyone's going somewhere else.
Yeah, well, two things. One, it's hard to blame companies for this when governments signal that they're willing to play the game. They get taught to do this, right? They get taught that, like, I should look for the handout. Frankly, because what if my competitor does and I don't? I'm on the back foot. Look, the short answer is there's this assumption always that we need to be in that line of work, right? Like, we have to outbid the Americans on aerospace or we won't be able to build planes here. We need to outbid the Americans on EVs or we won't be able to... Well, It's just assumed that we need to be in the business of building EVs. I'm sure it's nice to be in the business of building EVs if it makes economic sense, but to be in it for the sake of it, if it costs you more to be in it than you get from being in it, it doesn't make any sense. And the example we always use, and others have pointed this out, is Australia. I mean, Australia used to be a place where they built cars. Eventually, they just gave up because they didn't want to play this game. Guess what happened? There was no recession. There was no mass unemployment. There was no guess. It's just that the capital went into other industries and jobs and companies were created in other sectors. So this myth that if we lose, you know, building cars, we don't build cars in Canada, there will be this huge hole. It's simply not true. It has not played out anywhere else. And, you know, we have to start pushing back on this assumption that we must be in the business of doing this one specific thing.
Well, and the other aspect too, and I played that clip before you came on of Justin Trudeau saying this isn't just an economic policy, but it's an environmental policy and a social policy. I mean, he thinks that's a good thing. I think that makes it worse because it means the government is trying to inject almost like a social engineering into what could be and should be economic policy. And I think on electric vehicles, that's particularly concerning because we have huge issues with electric vehicles. You have a declining consumer interest in them. It's not to say that they won't eventually become the thing that everyone uses, but we're not there right now. So government is trying to manipulate the market and create a supply when there isn't a demand there. So it's not even like, for setting aside the moral question of whether you know, corporate welfare is good, it's not even like they're targeting it in a way that is particularly sustainable. This is still an emerging industry.
Absolutely. They're wasting a vast amount of resources pursuing that social goal. And I mean, you can agree or disagree with that goal, but the amount of resources they're deploying towards it are massive, right? I mean, I followed the Bombardier file for close to a decade, and the amount of money we're talking about on the EV file is about 10 times, you know, what got sunk into Bombardier, which was itself a disaster. So it's a huge sum of money in pursuit of a goal that, you know, I don't have a problem with electric vehicles, but the you know, they're going to become prominent when the market says so, when they make sense for most people. people when the price comes down, when the infrastructure is in place. It's not going to happen by government fiat. It's not going to happen because the government subsidizes the heck out of the production and the purchase, you know, and lays down this fiat that's saying we have to have it by this date. So this government is trying to speed something along that has to happen at its own pace, that the market is going to see to it, and they're wasting a massive amount of resources along the way.
Aaron Woodrick from the McDonald Laurier Institute. Always a pleasure, sir.
Thanks a lot, Andrew.
All right. Thank you. Well, we will move from one form of social engineering to another. We have spoken a fair bit in the last few weeks about immigration in Canada, which is often defended most significantly by governments who point to a very low birth rate in this country and use that as an excuse to basically say that we can't do immigration. So we're going to play in a little bit an interview I did with Jenny Roth on that. Do stay tuned for that. But I want to first and foremost talk about the other thing that government does that they pretend is scientific. They pretend is science-based policy, but is actually anything but. And this comes from the environment. Now, we have all heard time and time again. In fact, maybe someday we should put together a montage. Anytime there's any weather event in Canada that takes place, it is linked to man-made climate change that can only be solved by a carbon tax. If it's really windy one day, well, that was climate change. If there are wildfires, that's climate change. If there is flooding, if there's water, it's climate change. If there's no water, it's climate change. Snow, rain, wind, fall. They've taken like the old USPS slogan, which I'm trying to remember now. Let me look it up because it'll be funnier if I do it right. Never mind. I can't find it. It was the old like, oh, neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers. Well, for the government, it's snow or rain or heat or gloom of night is all climate change. That's basically the Stephen Gilbo approach to this. Now, never mind the fact that in Alberta, we had from officials yesterday a rather shocking announcement, although maybe not too shocking, depending on where you stand on this, that all of Alberta's wildfires in 2024 were human caused. Every single one. Except for, you know, a couple of smaller ones, was caused by man. And this is not man-made climate change. This is man-made wildfires that are often blamed by federal officials on climate change erroneously to justify their policy. So the reason I bring this up is to say that we should probably have a look at the data. And there was a study from the Fraser Institute that came out, I think, late last week, that all of these assumptions and assertions made by lawmakers on weather extremes increasing in frequency and severity, spurred on by humanity's greenhouse gas emissions, that actually doesn't hold water at all. That is the contention put forward by Kenneth Green, who is a senior fellow at the Fraser Institute and joins me now. Kenneth, always good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on today.
Good to be with you.
So we hear this time and time again from politicians. It's used to justify whatever ham-fisted climate policy they're putting on us. Usually it ends with a carbon tax. We have wildfires that we're told are the cause of climate change. We have rain, snow, doesn't matter. You're saying that, by the way, even the increased frequency is not valid, that they're hinging on this.
Well, that's right. We should start at the beginning, which is there is evidence that the climate has been getting warmer. The atmosphere is getting warmer. Satellite recordings suggest that the climate has been warming about 0.15 degrees centigrade per decade since they started taking those measurements in around 1980. But the subsidiary weather events that are supposedly related to the increased warming are much more ambivalent and ambiguous in terms of being able to see trends that correspond to the warming. So when you look at trends in wildfires, they're actually down over the last several decades in both number and the area of the countries burned in Canada and the US. Now there are anomaly years that are higher than normal, but the anomaly doesn't set the trend, right? So if you look at hurricanes, for example, tropical cyclones, there's evidence, not evidence of increasing severity or number, but in fact, decreasing severity and number. If you look at flooding and droughts, the evidence on flooding and drought are similarly contradictory. There, drought is not seen generally around the world as increasing, nor flooding. And so the extreme weather that's being pounded on by people like Minister Gilbo and others as being absolute proof that climate change is happening now and is being destructive now, and therefore we can't wait to act. We must act immediately with everything we have all at once. That's simply not based on actual empirical reality and an observation of real data.
And one of the things that I find interesting here is that there is no, I mean, this is a political question, so you can self-select out of answering if you'd prefer, but they act like there's so much certainty on this. They don't even say, listen, it's possible and we're concerned and there could be. They come out and it's that same fervor that you and I have spoken about that they exhibited with COVID policy as well. They believe they are the sole truth tellers and that they don't even leave any room for doubt. So when you come in here with your pesky facts, you know, someone would look at this and be like, well, what on earth are they trying to sell us?
Right. Well, I mean, that's a point I make often. I think I've made before with you, which is I don't tend to speak in terms of governments and places and politicians as being as lying so much about climate change as simply exaggerating that what's known and how well it's known. And this is where the IPCC, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, falls short of being a really clear source of the sciences, because they also overstate their certainty and confidence. And if you question them, that gets you an automatic label of denier, and you're cast out of polite discourse. But there is no question that these claims of what we know about extreme weather are exaggerated. Our data is not that good. Really, we haven't been monitoring the entire Earth in detail via robust satellites and technologies for more than 50 years, right? It really only started in around 1980 with a decent measurement. So we're talking about limited data, a very big planet, and the data is almost all in the developed countries, the high resolution data. And so to talk about that information with such overwhelming confidence that you can't be challenged and you are absolutely right. It's intellectual and political hubris, really.
And I wanted to point out here as well, you're not drawing your data from, you know, Bobby Joe's science blog. You're drawing data from, just to read through some of the footnotes here, the World Meteorological Organization, the Royal Society, the Journal of Hydrology, the World Meteorological Organization as well. I mean, it's their own data that are showing what you're describing here, which is that, you know, we're not seeing an increase in droughts. We're not seeing an increase in hurricanes. We're seeing a decline in flooding. So how is the data from all of the, how are the data from the official sources getting reinterpreted as saying really the opposite of what they say?
Well, that's a problem again with the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change communication process, as well as just the broader climate change literature, which is these data sources are generally covered by those groups that are reporting on climate change, but they also do bring in the other sources. They bring in other anecdotal and smaller sample size studies. There are many, many studies on these things. So the United Nations IPCC does their report summarizing the literature. Yes, they will refer to the same things I did, which are actually just the hard data. I'm looking for when I'm reporting my data, I'm just looking for measurements using robust technology, not small studies of modeling of change. For example, most studies, when you look at it for wildfires and things, they're computer models of what they think has happened in the trends, not actually measurements. So that's why it gets distorted in the political process, because they don't limit themselves only to these sources that are measured data. They bring in a whole bunch of modeled computer studies that are both retroactive and prospective, that what's going to happen in the future. And they mesh them together as if they're all equally robust as going out and counting and measuring something when they're not. And they tend to easily be exaggerated in the direction of bad change, right? Of negative change. So they get published a lot too.
I think the wildfire one I always find the most interesting, because when there's a flood, you generally don't assume that some guy in Somalia left the tap on too long and it caused the ocean to flood. I mean, you can't really blame the flooding on individuals, but with wildfires you can. And we know increasingly that intentional or accidental forest fires are quite commonplace. And in Canada, we've seen this when there were wildfires in Quebec. They were linked back to arson. In Alberta, I mentioned a few moments ago, the government has come out and said almost all of their wildfires as of late have been human caused. And this is not something where there is at all an increase. But even with arsons, there has been a decline in wildfires over recent decades.
Yes, there's been an overall decline in number and area extent burned, even with increasing arson. Assuming it's increasing, we don't know. I mean, I haven't looked at arson arrest data, so we don't know if there's more or if it's always been this way. And there have been a lot of fire bugs, which we called them when I was a kid. But one of the things about wildfires, and as well as drought, and as well as floods, is that these are multifactorial things. Right now, we're talking about them in the context of climate change, and that's how politicians are wanting to talk about them as part of the climate crisis and all of that. But you know what causes more fires are forest management as well is a big factor, land development is a big factor, deforestation can be a big factor. And the same is true of drought, which is changes in the land from developing areas, converting to farmland from forested areas. These are multifactorial things that have human elements far beyond the emission of greenhouse gases that warms the climate a little bit and then comes back down somehow, changes the hot weather patterns so it's a little hotter every summer or in summertime, and you get more fires. It's a very simplistic connection they have made between greenhouse gas emissions and climate change and changes in weather events, drought, flooding, hurricanes. There are far more factors involved in that.
Well, fascinating stuff. As always, you can head on over to the Fraser Institute's website and read this report, Extreme Weather and Climate Change. Kenneth Green, always appreciate the truth-telling and narrative-shattering you provide. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrew. It's always good to be with you.
All right, Dr. Kenneth Green, a pleasure as always. We did things a little out of order here. Kenneth was early, so I was glad we could bring him on early. But I did want to share this interview I did with Ginny Roth last week. She is with Crestview Strategies, but we were talking about birth rates. And again, there are some things in here you might find uncomfortable, because anytime the question is about should government do something, I understand the impulse to say no. So it was at least worth exploring, because government uses low birth rates as justification for high immigration. But is that really saying that they could or should be doing something on the core demography of birth rates? That was at least the starting point for this conversation we did at the Canada Strong and Free Network conference in Ottawa. Very pleased to be sitting down right now with Ginny Roth, who is a partner at Crestview Strategies, also one of the preeminent conservative commentators of the era. You see her work all over, including in The Hub. You see her on TV panels, and we are pleased she is gracing us with her presence today. Ginny, good to talk to you. Thanks for sitting down.
Very nice to be here.
So I wanted to talk to you as someone who has written about some pretty complex and sometimes controversial issues, but someone who's also worked very much in mainstream politics about how we navigate what is often seen as a third rail, which is family policy, and there are a lot of places to go within that in the current political context. And I'll ask you first off, what a conservative policy on family would look like that you would champion that would also be viable within the political confines we have today?
Sure, yeah. Look, there's no question regular people get a little bit nervous when you start talking about family, because it feels like something that's kind of private. It's people's own personal decision. And ultimately, if you, like me, believe that we should err in the direction of sort of freedom and letting people choose things for themselves and not imposing things from on high, then you have to be thoughtful about family policy. Look, I think there's cultural things conservatives can do, like make the argument for families, make the argument for a culture that supports families. But that's a little bit high-minded. There are also practical things we can do. So at the federal level, the Liberals are doing their own family policy, and I think it's bad. I think their child care, very, very one-size-fits-all. It has to be between 9 and 5. There's a massive shortage of supply. So there are all these subsidized spaces, not enough supply to actually give families spots in most neighborhoods. Is just not going to satisfy people in the long run. But, you know, the Harper era subsidizing people and giving them checks if they have kids, which, you know, to Trudeau's credit, he actually, first he leaned into that policy, then he went with this one-size-fits-all childcare. I think if we can go back to that, this idea that money follows the family, and that you're not certainly that you're not penalized for having kids, and there are some penalties that we should remove, but also that you're encouraged to, and you're going to be supported if you do, because it's hard, and especially in a cost of living crisis, it's especially hard. So there are a couple of things I think we do at other levels as well.
So to go back to some of those Harper policies, I mean, the one that comes to mind immediately is the child fitness tax credit. That's a very family-oriented policy. It makes things easier for families. Income splitting, which was a bit more contentious in the Harper government, that's again an issue that makes things easy. But a lot of the problems with these issues is that they don't actually go to the core of building families. They certainly don't encourage people to have families. And, you know, on one hand, the idea of government centrally planning family just terrifies me as much as government centrally planning anything else. But on the other hand, we do have a problem. I mean, we do have a birth rate issue in Canada, and I don't think there's been a time that I can recall a Canadian politician talking about it, but it is a factor there. So what role should government have, if any, in correcting that? And if so, what's the mechanism you can get there that doesn't necessarily look like government trying to, you know, go around and manage people's family compositions?
Sure. Well, I actually think income splitting does could make a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And the reason I think income splitting is powerful is because it tells families, we're going to tax you as a family unit, mm-hmm. not as individuals. And I don't know about other people. I find when I go to file my taxes, it's weird to file taxes as an individual. That's not how we run mm-hmm. our household. We run our household as a family, and we should be kind of taxed that way. And if there's a way you can structure your family because one of you wants to stay home part-time or full-time, and that means someone has a disproportionately lower income, being able to not be penalized for that effectively mm-hmm. And making that choice just a little bit easier for people, I think could actually be pretty powerful, not just for the literal political outcome or policy outcome, but because of the cultural message it sends, which is, as a government, as a country, we value families. I think that, you know, you see Hungary experimenting with, I think it's like after a certain number of kids, it's either 4 or 5 or something, they just pay no income tax.
Yeah, yeah.
That I think is meaningful, right? Like you may choose to have 4 kids just because if the government's going to make it that easy for me, maybe it's worth doing. And I wonder if you were to do things like that, it would have trickle down cultural impacts so that you'd end up being in environments that are more kid friendly. It wouldn't be so weird if your kid's crying on a plane. The idea you apologize if your kid's crying, like what kind of society is that? If you're, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's also, I don't want to put the blame squarely on government here, even predominantly on government, because there's a tremendous cultural and societal problem. I mean, you certainly don't have big role models and popular culture figures that are speaking up and bolstering the idea of family. If anything, it goes the other way. You get, you know, Meghan Markle does an interview or something and talks about how, you know, children are terrible for climate. So you do see these cultural forces that try to discourage and disincentivize. And that's, I guess, the big problem, is that you don't have anyone that's really leading the charge and saying families are important. And historically, that's been the domain of, I'd say, a subset of the political class that's often not really all that mainstream.
That's right. And, you know, when you think about the subtle influences that culture has, there is a role for public policy to play in that. I think about schools and curriculum. Mm-hmm. You know, our kids are spending hours and hours, you know, the huge portion of their day in schools being taught curriculum by teachers. And today, I think they're being taught, you know, climate change is threatening the planet. And if you have kids, you're contributing to that. And so just letting parents choose what schools their kids go to and therefore what mm-hmm. curriculum they consume. I mean, I'm from Ontario. We don't have that option. In Alberta, at least, if you're a parent who wants your kids to be exposed to the kind of values that would support family formation, you can choose to do that. You can send them to a classical school. You can avail yourself of school choice. We don't have that option in Ontario and a number of other provinces across Canada, and I think that could make a big difference.
I don't want to do like the safe conservative leader thing of making everything about the economy, but I also do think that economic policy can be and often is family policy. Like if you're looking at inflation, cost of living, all of these things, that is a very real consideration. If you've got a family with 2 kids that's struggling to put food on the table as it is, the incentive to have a 3rd kid is just not there.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Look, the birth rates crowd would resist that argument a little mm-hmm. bit, because a lot of the research they do says that people fundamentally, it's not about economics, it's about culture. Having said that, I think economics impacts culture.
It does.
And so, you know, Pierre Poilievre spoke earlier today, and he said, I can't remember what the percentage was, but there's a huge, terrifying percentage of young people who've just given up completely on being able to have a home, mm-hmm. a house. A house and maybe therefore a home, right? And if you are psychologically accepting that you will never be able to afford a house, at what point do you say, well, I'm probably not going to be able to have time to have kids? Which means, like, is there really a point in getting married? Is there really a point in dating and having serious relationships? Like, I think that has a really corrosive impact mm-hmm. on even the really early stage choices you make around potentially having a family. Yeah. And I it concerns me that today we don't even know yet, I think, what Gen Z is going to do when it comes to childbearing.
Yeah.
And I think we could see birth rates plummet even more.
Well, and Poilievre has joked about it, but there's a serious point here. I mean, if you're 25 and living with your parents, your dating life is probably going to be a bit cramped. Totally. I mean, I would love to have been able to blame my dating issues on that when I was single, but I had myself to blame. But there is a real thing about if you're delaying your entry into adulthood, absolutely, in a way, you're delaying everything else. Yeah. And then at a certain point when you might be married and have a house and have a career, oh, you're 35. And sure, you can have kids at that age, but it's a much different calculation internally than if you're there 10 years earlier.
That's right. If you're a woman in her late 20s and you're trying to date and your dating pool, these men are living in their mom's basements, mm-hmm, and who can blame them? They can't afford to live anywhere else. That's not conducive, yeah, to the kind of becoming an adult, going through those life stages, dating successfully, getting married, that will then go on to, and to your point about this sort of fertility window question, it's awkward, I think, for people to talk about. Yeah. But I think culturally we cover that up a little bit too much. You know, if you go to a doctor's office as a woman, they'll bend over backwards to tell you how to avoid getting pregnant, right? And that's fine for many women in many situations. I'm not saying that shouldn't be the case, but there's almost no education you get as a woman about how to get pregnant. Mm-hmm. God forbid, you know?
Yeah.
And then a lot of women find themselves at 35, maybe grateful they're able to have one child or in unfortunate situations, really wishing that they'd been able to start earlier.
So you worked with Pierre Poilievre in his leadership campaign as his director of communications. He's certainly been unafraid to tackle some bigger issues. I've not heard him go down the birth rate road, but I'm curious, do you think, to put on your pundit hat here for a moment, is he capable of having that conversation? And it's not even just a him question. Is Canada capable of having a politician talk, sure, about this?
So it was interesting. In his speech today, you know, I think he's very careful to stick to the big, tough problems, mm-hmm, for which there are solutions, right? And for which he can, if he were to win and become prime minister, he can kind of work his way through solving some of the basic problems. Mm-hmm. Because I think he has some faith that take crime, right? We talked about housing, we talked about the economy.
Well, there's a family policy for you right,
right
there.
Imagine, yeah, if you could. I live in a neighborhood with lots of families, and they're frankly up in arms because we have a so-called safe injection, I don't think it should be called that, yeah, a consumption site in our neighborhood, and kids are picking up fentanyl patches, wow, in the playground. So I think his view is, if we can get some of those basic things right, everything else will kind of work itself out. And I think he's careful to be consistent in being that kind of conservative. And I think he knows that if he gets sort of too prescriptive about, and that's because I want people to have more kids or because I want to have some sort of top-down solution, yeah, that's going to drive family formation, that's going to narrow his appeal. And that's not what he wants. He wants to be able to win the kind of mandate where he can actually make a difference in people's lives. And I think that's wise, right? Honestly, it's why I'm glad that CSFN has this and why True North exists, right? Mm-hmm. Why we have all these players in the movement so that we can have some of the conversations that maybe are appeal to a narrower group of people and start to drive some public demand. Like, what I would really love to see is if in a few years we can tell a story to the public where they go, yeah, actually, I'm concerned about birth rates, and there starts to be that demand, then politicians can respond, mm-hmm, and meet that demand with solutions.
Yeah, that whole downstream of culture,
yeah,
attitude,
exactly,
right?
And yes. So let's let, you know, Poilievre should let us impact culture. You and me, Andrew, will do it, just the two of us.
All right.
and then he should tackle politics.
All right, yeah, and that's the thing. A lot of people will look to politicians. I don't want to let politicians off the hook entirely, but a lot of people will look to them and say, why aren't you doing this? And, you know, they can turn back and say, well, why aren't you doing it?
That's right.
Why don't you prove there's some support for this, and then I can go there. So, all right, well, glad you're not afraid to take this on. Jenny Roth, always good to talk to you.
You too, Andrew.
Jenny Roth, partner at Crestview Strategies, great writer, great contributor. We've always whenever we try to get her on the show, there's always like a timing issue. So it's hard to evade that when you can just like pull someone in the hallway at a conference, which is why it's just a horrendous thing that we all had to be Zoom for everything for like 3 years. So good to have the return of the in-person world. That does it for us for today and for this week. See some of you on Sunday at the Ottawa Book Expo. That'll be a lot of fun. And we will see you tomorrow on Off the Record right here on True North, and then back on regularly scheduled programming on Monday. So lots coming up. Thank you. God bless, and good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.